Today's podcast is brought to you by Health IQ and another sponsor. But right now we're going to get to Health IQ because they're back for another round after the first couple months. We touched base and I said, hey, Health IQ, how'd it go? They said, great. There are actually 16 trainiacs that have signed up and every single one of them has saved money on their life insurance.
16. That's amazing, actually.
It's a good round number. That's more life insurance than I sold ever as a life insurance advisor.
Does that say something about how good you were at that job?
Fantastic. Health IQ, very good company. We're big fans of it. Unfortunately, we can't use it because they're a US-based life insurance agency and we're up in Canada. But what they've done is they've set up life insurance specifically designed for swimmers, cyclists, runners, vegans, people who take care of themselves. And those people, like us, trainiacs, can save as much as 25% on their life insurance as opposed to paying the same as the unhealthy burger and fries sitting on the couch people.
Well, that's an amazing thing.
Great deal. Great deal. Go check out healthiq.com/triathlon Taryn or use the coupon code triathlon Taryn if you just call in and let them know that you came from us. Next sponsor, NTK, take it away.
Four Sigmatics back.
They're back with their mushroom coffee. I've been singing their praises.
You love this stuff.
Love it. I probably have it up to four times a day, and I'm going to give you guys a recipe idea that I've talked about a lot that has probably been a huge hit, one of the biggest recipe hits that we've had as Gracie scratches her collar. The bulletproof, air quotes, bulletproof coffee that's taken the world by storm. I've veganized it, and instead of just straight up coffee, I've Four Sigmaticized it, because using that Four Sigmatic cordyceps or mushroom coffee, you get antioxidants, you get adaptogens, boost your immune system, lower caffeine, less gut rot, all good things. Very tasty.
So are you drinking less actual coffee these days? I don't know this because I don't see you in the daytime.
Mm-hmm. Instead of four cups, I would say it's two cups of coffee tops and then probably two or three cups of Four Sigmatic.
Well, thanks Four Sigmatic for making Taryn healthier.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I feel tippy top of the heap of fitness right now. Go to foursigmatic.com/triathlon Taryn to save 15%. Just straight up, or if you use the coupon code Triathlon Taryn, 15% off of any Four Sigmatic product. Today's podcast guests, Jeannie Seymour and Justin Metzler, which are known on Instagram as #Metzelmore.
Yes.
And Kim petitions that if they get married, they should change their last name to
Metzelmore.
I say #Metzelmore.
And I say that's absurd and you can't do that. So if you two get married, if you're listening, I think that you should just make a new last name, make it Metzelmore, because it's a fun word to say and we really like it.
I'm a big fan of the hashtag.
Everyone
Metzelmore.
Wins.
I met Jeannie and Justin down at the QT2 camp in Claremont. Really, really nice folk. And Jeannie has had an amazing last couple of seasons, been all over the podium. Justin, in the last couple of years, has been all over top fives, top tens, really talented, aerobic, long course kind of guy, and just about to step up to the Ironman distance, and just recently got off a brutal couple of weeks at Oceanside 70.3, where that race didn't go nearly as well as he thought. He had actually ended up DNFing. And then the next week, went to Half Ironman Leo Chow, and well, we'll just let him talk about it.
It's a great story. We also talked to them about not living in a house with two triathletes, but three, and what that's like.
And finally, as a real capper, we get into how they met.
They're adorable.
They're the nicest.
They're just really adorable together. I'm sure Justin won't appreciate my use of the word adorable, but they are.
Totes adorbs.
Totes adorbs.
Enjoy the interview, everyone. So we got Justin Metzler and Jeannie Seymour here, #Metzelmore, which I'll probably say, we should start a drinking game of how many times I'm going to say that over the course of this podcast.
It's a fun thing to say.
It is fun. Welcome to the show here, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
So let's get into we always like to start off with really hard hitting questions. Jeannie, I have to ask about your sleeping habits while on a mode of transportation, like planes, trains, automobiles. Why won't you let Big Mets share pictures of you sleeping with the world? I think that would be phenomenal triathlon content.
I don't know. I'm just embarrassed. I sleep a lot. probably see more during travel than at home. I'm like a baby. I like the motion.
You're lulled to sleep.
So like how intense is this? Because he sent me a picture when the plane hadn't even taken off yet. Like, is this just conditioned into you now that you hop on a plane and bam, you're asleep?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Like, I get into the plane and I'm just like, you know, it kind of takes long to get up in the air. And it's just like from the time like that process happens, I just seem to just drift into like a long sleep. And it's kind of beautiful, actually.
It is really beautiful because then I take photos of it and it's just amazing for everyone.
No, I don't like that.
And this is after a full night's sleep. Like if you, middle of the afternoon or say not even like an early morning flight, but you know, a nice 11 a.m. flight, you've just had a nice full night of sleep. You got, you know, leisurely to get to the airport and you're still going to fall asleep.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It just happens. And then I will wake up in the flight, like maybe an hour and a half into the flight, and then I'll be awake and then I'll do stuff. But like, I just get down and have a good nap and then I'm good.
Well, good for you. That is a lucky thing,
that
quite honestly.
That is a talent.
Yeah. So when you're on the road, speaking of modes of transportation and traveling, you room with Kevin Collington.
No, they live with Kevin.
Oh, you live with Kevin.
They live
Sorry.
With Kevin. Yep.
Not just on the road.
Yeah, we do.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So
we call him Papa Kevo.
All right.
He's like our dad.
He's our triathlon dad.
Well, then what's it like living in an all Ironman household? I mean, I live with one and he's not even a full Ironman. He's a half Ironman. And that's a lot of Ironman in my home to have, you know, you guys have a lot more in your home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Kevin, the first time I came to Boulder was in 2014. And Kevin and I had a mutual friend. I'd actually never met Kevin. I was just sort of like a fanboy. In fact, actually, there was at one point where I had won like a Kevin Collington contest. He was sponsored by some company and I like guessed his bike split at a race and like won this trainer that like they sent to my house. And I was like a total fanboy of Kevin. And then I moved to Boulder, moved in, and then took a sublease off one of the roommate who was Kevin's at the time. And then, yeah, I've been living with Kevin ever since. I think, I don't know, what's one word to describe our household? I'd say like very professional and businesslike.
Really?
It's nice to be on the same schedule, you know, and we eat early, we go to bed early, so it's nice and quiet. We obviously sleep a lot. We also get up early. So it kind of works out, you know. I kind of like it. Like it would be really different if you had like a college roommate that kind of goes out and comes back and at early hours in the morning. So it kind of works out for us.
You know? Yeah, I think it works. It works similar to the way that Jeannie and I work as a couple because, you know, a roommate is obviously not the same, but, you know, you sort of have to be on the same time frame. You can't be on polar opposites of like, you know, one person's partying and, you know, staying up late. And I think we all sort of are doing the same thing and sort of trying to achieve the same goals. So it just works. I think it works pretty well.
But here's what I envision. I envision a lot of like wet Speedos hanging off the backs of chairs, wet running gear draped all over,
everywhere.
Bike parts everywhere. This might be what I live with. I'm thinking it's times three with you.
Yeah. I think we make most of the mess in the household. Kevin is one of the neatest people you'll ever meet. And so like his stuff is like, you'll never see any of Kevin's stuff. Maybe his shoes at the front door, but otherwise there's no signs of Kevin. Like we're just like spread out.
There's two of us.
Yeah. And we just basically, it's all our stuff. Just like triathlon. Yeah.
You know, the biggest thing is actually the bikes. Like we live in, it's not a very big apartment and we just have so many bikes here. Like we're constantly just juggling, moving bike here, bike there, you know, between the three of us, we have a nice little stable. So I think that's the biggest thing with the household rather than like sweaty clothes or shoes lying around, you know, jiggling all the bikes and bike gear.
Yeah. And not to mention that like it also helps like obviously splitting a ring because we live in like a really nice location in Boulder and Boulder's obviously not the cheapest place to live, but yeah, it definitely helps to split that ring so we can afford to live here, you know.
I've got to ask, what's the N number? Like how many bikes is a lot of bikes?
Do you want to guess?
Yeah, hang on.
Can I guess? I'll guess. Okay, I'm gonna go a road for sure. I'm gonna go two tri bikes each. Mountain bike, a commuter. Where are they commuting to though?
Hang on,
around Boulder.
I don't know.
I'm going to go 16 is my guess.
16. All right, if we had 16 bikes in our apartment, we literally would have nowhere to sleep. Like, the bikes would have to be in the beds with us if we had 16 here. That's the size of, like, the square footage we're working with. There's 10.
Well, 10, no, I mean, 10, good. That's is not much less than 16.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
But see, they're professional triathletes. I don't think they're riding commuters around, right? So I think you cut out three bikes right there. You overshot yourself with the commuters. And they don't need fat bikes because they're living in Boulder, and I think the weather's a bit better.
That's right.
But all you guys, you also have, you guys get around by scooter, don't you?
No.
At one point we did. I think when we were living in Florida for a while, we didn't have my car. We left it in Boulder. We rented a scooter. We were just slumming it 1 year. And I lived that scoot life. It's not very glamorous.
Hashtag scoot life.
This has gone totally off the rails here, but I like this chat. Let's get into triathlon. So, Justin, you've just come off of a very, should we say, harrowing couple of races. I just read your blog post giving the Coles notes, and I watched your Instagram live, which you should download and put on YouTube because it was like broken man, but also putting a good spin on it. While at the same time, I think like probably sitting on a pillow because you had to sit on your bike post.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you give us the rundown of Oceanside and Leocho?
Yeah. I mean, you guys were down at the camp, or Taryn, you were down at the camp in Florida. And that was like as fit as I've been, I think, ever in my life. I was just like crushing all of those sessions. So I came off the camp feeling so strong and so confident and so excited to start racing again. I had already raced once this year in South Africa, but I was like really in no position to be competitive. I just started my training, and yeah, everything had pretty much gone as perfect as I could have asked for in terms of the buildup until sort of mid-March. And then I had about 3 weeks from the end of that camp to the start of Oceanside, and things just didn't sort of settle in the way that Jesse, my coach, or I would have really liked. I just was forcing my training sessions. I had a tough time coming back up to altitude, which is pretty rare for me. I wasn't really absorbing any of the camp that I had done or the workouts that I was doing when I was back in here in Boulder. So I'm sort of known for going out there and doing pretty massive training and then at least being consistent, not necessarily knocking the sessions out of the park every time, but just being able to go out there and do my job every single day. And I was pulling out of workouts and just totally doing uncustomary stuff. So the buildup to Oceanside wasn't necessarily perfect, but because I had gone so well in Claremont, I thought I was still going to be okay. And then I had a really good swim in Oceanside, probably one of my career best swims, coming out of the water fifth. That's sort of where I thought I was going to be. And I just did it, which was nice. But then I got on the bike and all that training that I had done sort of just like caught up to me. And I just could tell something was wrong. I was just getting passed by all the guys. And typically I can ride pretty strong at the front. So yeah, Oceanside, I got dropped from the front group that I swam with, and then another pack came by, and then a third pack came by. And at the point where I sort of knew, even if I had an amazing run, I wasn't going to be anywhere near the money, I had to make like a really tough sort of business call and say, hey, look, I'm not going to just run a half marathon for the sake of running half marathon. I know I can run 13 miles fast. I'm going to sort of, I know something's off, so I'm going to try and rest and then prepare for China the next weekend.
So when you're deciding to DNF there, a DNF for you is very different from a DNF for an age grouper. Like a DNF from an age grouper is blow up and like be escorted off the course. But in your case, you're literally managing the next couple months of racing at that point, right?
Yeah. And it's a kind of an odd, rare feeling in a position that I had never been in before. That was only my second career DNF. The first time I was like super ill, just sick, and I couldn't do the race. So this was a different thing. It was one of those things where, I mean, you hear about pros doing it all the time, but I was always one of those people who came from the mindset of like, I respect triathlon, I respect racing, and I respect the age groupers. I just want to do justice to the race. So even if I've had bad days before, I've just gutted it out and finished it. And this was a unique situation because I was racing 6 days later. And as I become more mature and rely more on my, you know, prize money for to pay bills, you got to make those hard calls sometimes. So I think if you talk to any sort of seasoned pro, they've all had to make calls of that nature before. And they're really hard, but it's just sort of the nature of the beast and the fact that I rely on my body to get paid and pay the bills.
So, I mean, you just said you've never been as fit as you were at your training camp. So what went wrong between the camp and Oceanside where it sort of all fell apart?
Yeah, I think I had went right from Claremont, Tucson, Arizona for some sponsor commitments. And I didn't necessarily have the ability to recover the way that I wanted to just because of all the travel. And then I got back to Boulder. Although I had some downtime at the camp, it wasn't like pure, true recovery. And I came back and I think Jesse and I jumped right into some intense training, sort of trying to get that, eke out that little extra half a percent, which in hindsight was sort of the wrong move because I pushed through all these, like a week of training sessions where I knew I wasn't feeling good. And I just sort of was not listening to my body, which after that first week, I started listening to my body, which was a good thing. I didn't continue to go on that path. But because of the travel and because of the recovery from camp and the return to altitude, it's hard to tell what is all of these other factors and what is my body saying, hey, no, dude, you need a rest. So I just pushed through those sessions. I never was able to sort of get on the front foot of the recovery. And yeah, just I think that it just sort of caught up with me on race day. Or I think I could have gotten through a lower intense race, but Oceanside is such a competitive high level event that if you're not on your A game, it's like, see you later, you know. By. So the competition was just too intense for me to be able to, you know, fake my way through it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a deep field. I want to just keep, you know, hitting you when you're down here for just a little bit and talk about Leo Cho. So out to Leo Cho. How do you pronounce it? Leo Chow?
Yeah. Leo Cho. Yeah.
Leo Cho.
Which is an Ironman race in China.
Half Ironman race in China that you went to right after Oceanside. I'll kind of speed up what happened. Everything's looking good. You're feeling good. Going through your normal process of spending time in the hotel gym, back to the hotel room to recover. And then you sprain your ankle 3 days out of the race so badly that you could barely walk to the bathroom. How do you start adjusting your preparation and race strategy considering that, like, you got to race, it's a business.
But how do you even, like, race when you have get an injury like that 3 days before, I guess is my question. It's not like, how do you manage it so you can race? How on earth do you think you can race at all?
Yeah, I think it was really challenging for me. I mean, both physically dealing with the actual injury itself, I was really concerned about because it was so swollen, it was so painful. But Jesse said he had dealt, my coach, I spoke to him a whole bunch over the course of the week, and he said he had dealt with similar situations before. And it's sort of like a 36-hour, really bad, really painful, super swollen, but then it gets dramatically better like the 24 hours after that. So I sort of just trusted him and said, I've never been in this situation before. This thing hurts. I'm going to do everything in my control. But it was one of those things where I couldn't control how fast it was going to heal. I couldn't control how it was going to feel. I couldn't control when the race was going to come. The race was coming Saturday, 72 hours after I heard it, no matter what. So those are things I couldn't really focus on. I just said, the only thing I can take care of is my mindset. And so it was really just Jeannie and Jesse who were there for me and just helped me sort of get my mind right.
Yeah, I mean, these are the things you don't really hear outside of triathlon, right? The week before China, Justin was really, really down, very emotional, which is not like him, and pretty hard. Like, I had to convince him on the phone every time he called me that everything's going to be okay. Like, he just has to relax. He has to calm down. Like, and that's really hard. Like, for me to be so far away from him and try to, like, support him through, like, that kind of mental state was kind of tough for us, you know? But, like, he made the sacrifice and he traveled all the way to China. So you've got to just, like, see things through and just trust that everything's going to be okay, like, come race day. But it was definitely hard.
Yeah, and thankfully the ankle did end up being fine on the race day, so that didn't end up being a limiter for me, but it just made the build up all that more stressful.
Yeah.
How did you sprain it, by the way?
Yeah, so my China protocol, I think I referenced it in my blog, but I go to bed at like 6 or 7 p.m. and then wake up at like 1 or 2 a.m. and I sort of stay on American time. So when I come back, I'm not jet lagged, but you're still up early enough for the race. So it ends up working out well. Anyways, I was up super early. I rode the trainer in my hotel room from like, I don't know, 3:30 to 5 a.m. or something. And then the sun was just coming up and I went out at like that dusky time, and the roads from the hotel over to this park that was pretty nice for running were like really bad. The sidewalk was all cracked and stuff. And I just didn't see this big sort of like crack in the sidewalk. And I just rolled it right over and sort of like felt this pop right away. So I thought it was worse than it was, but I think it was, I know it was a bad sprain. I was obviously able to do the race, but it was really painful immediately and super like swelled up just like right away. Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Yeah, that was a bad sprain. Back in my younger days, I was a really cool skateboarder. And probably nice. Sprained each. I know, it was super nice.
Happy.
Yeah.
I see those pictures.
He references this often. He goes back to these glory days often.
Yeah, it was like a glory day when I landed a trick, one trick. But yeah, I've seen ankles like that constantly. That was a legitimate sprain. That was bad. But it didn't just end there. This is the last thing that I'll hit you with while you're down.
And we'll get to Jeannie in a second. We'll turn the spotlight on Jeannie. Don't you worry. Yeah. Yours is coming.
How's your butt doing? You got the worst saddle sore ever on the bike.
That's not a question to get asked often. How's your butt doing?
I know. Yeah. I mean, so during the race, I take my bike apart completely to travel. So I'm really detail oriented with my bike. I think anyone that knows me knows that I'm super like anal about everything, all of my equipment.
Can I just pause and say you're really anal as we're talking about a sore butt?
I chose that word on purpose, by the way. I'm going to go with detailed rather than anal. Anyway. So like the one bolt that I don't really like touch is just one that sort of holds the seat clamp, the clamp that holds on the rails of the seat post. And in Oceanside the week before, I did the whole ride. I finished the bike, but the bike was super bumpy there. And I typically would think to tighten that bolt because I would assume it would come loose. But for whatever reason, I just didn't remember or whatever because of the ankle, I forgot. I just didn't tighten that bolt down. It's one of the few bolts I don't actually completely disassemble when I travel with the bike. And about 20K into the 90K ride, I could feel the clamp came loose. The bolt came loose down a little spring. And the saddle just shifted all the way back. And then over the course of like 20K to about 70K, it just came looser and looser and looser. And ultimately the top of the clamp completely came off. And at 80K, the whole saddle came off.
Like it fell onto the road?
Yeah, the saddle actually just kind of like fell off the side and was hanging on by like one of the rails. And then it was just sort of like stuck on the post, but just like down a little bit, obviously not rideable. And then the top part of the clamp fell off the road and like the spring that holds on the clamp on the side of the road.
So did you literally have like the top of the seat post in your in your detail oriented?
Yeah, there was no insertion. Like there was no
Taryn was hoping there was, hey? The look on his face, he was just hoping.
This is a family podcast.
Yeah, I think you could say penetration on the podcast, right?
But like you were sitting and putting weight on it, or were you out of the saddle standing for the final 20K?
So there was a big group of us. There was like a group of eight people sort of riding along. I was at the front of it the entire race doing the majority of the work with Craig Alexander and Guy Crawford. The three of us were sort of changing off the leads with the rest of the guys sort of, I'm going to say, sit behind riding legally, quotation marks.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. They were behind us. And yeah, so like at 80K, felt it come off, and then I didn't really know what to do. From like 20K to 70K, I was yelling at the Chinese official who didn't speak any English for like a mechanic, and I wanted to do a Peter Sagan. And like while the clamp was still on there, I thought I could like be real smooth and like take a 4 mil Allen key and like tighten it down while I was riding. But I couldn't communicate to get a 4 mil Allen key from the guy. So anyways, the thing just flew off, and I fall to the back of the group, and for like 5 or 6K of the final, let's call it 15, I was just up out of the saddle, like 55-11, just mashing the gear standing. But my quads just like started cramping after like 6 or 7Ks of that, you know, it'd be like standing for 10-15 minutes climbing. And so ultimately I was like, I need some relief here. And I just put my butt down on the saddle. It was sort of like where I typically sit anyways, which is sort of like right on the nose of the saddle. I just sat like on like the hard, non-nervous part of, you know, my under region. And that was actually, it was okay. It like gave me a decent amount of relief, but then, you know, I'd switch off and go and stand and go again, but I didn't get dropped from the group and I was able to make it back to transition. That was like my sole goal from 20K to 90K, 70Ks of riding was just get back to T2 with the group. Like do not get dropped, because I knew if I got dropped from the group, then my chances of being in the top five were over. So I said, I just have to do whatever it takes to get back to transition.
The happiest dismount of your life.
Yeah, that was a good feeling.
I'm sorry to have to bring that up. This is like Tin Cup where Roy McAvoy gets like the 15 on the final hole. Nobody's going to remember that Alistair Brownlee won that race, but people will remember that you had to sit on a seat post.
Yeah. You know, and I think I shared the story and the honest story from not a point of like me complaining, saying, hey, look, like, look at all these shitty things that happened to me over the course of my 2 week trip. It wasn't that. It was like, look, it would be really easy for me to pull out of this race. All the cards were stacked against me, but I wanted to finish. Like there was something pushing me to the finish line. Like I didn't have the race that I wanted, and I didn't get the luck that I typically would, or that most athletes had just a normal race day, but I gritted it out and I was tenacious and I wanted to race. And even though like I got off the bike and my quads were on fire from riding like that, I did the best I could and still managed to get in the top five and get paid and like do all the things that I would normally attain to do despite given the circumstances or the cards that I was dealt on the day. So I just took the positives out of it and was proud with just being able to finish and get to the finish line. So
Yeah. All jokes aside, watching your Instagram live after explaining everything that went through happened over the course of those 2 weeks. That's why exactly what you said there is why I said, if you downloaded that and put it up to Instagram, those are lessons that any athlete can take. I think especially age groupers realizing that it's not going to go well all the time and mm-hmm. you can still finish and do quite well.
Yeah, absolutely. So
that was cool.
All right, Jeannie,
yeah,
your turn. So
now the rock star.
Yeah.
Put her in.
So you did pretty much everything as a kid. You did ballet, track, swimming, diving, field hockey, indoor hockey, rugby, diving, cross country, mm-hmm. a little bit of cycling. But we're kind of curious about your take on ballet specifically, because there is some thought mm-hmm. that getting kids into gymnastics and similar sports when they're young helps them to develop really good body awareness that they kind of carry through the rest of their lives. So two-part question for you. Do you agree with that? And then number two, what do you think about kids being put into sport-specific development super early on, really young?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I definitely agree with that. I was lucky in a sense. My mom just threw me in when I was like 4 years old. She just threw me in into ballet class, and like I kind of made friends, and I just, you know what I learned more than anything is just like discipline and just like seeing something through. My parents were always supportive of anything, no matter what I did. They just wanted to see me kind of finish things and like just like, you know, show that commitment. And but in terms of coordination and all of that, I think it's so great for youngsters to do that. And I think also ankle stability is what I got a lot. Like Justin's talking about twisting, like I twisted my ankle so much, but it was always okay because I always had that like foundation from dancing that kept my ankles really strong. So that helped for my other sports growing up. But also the body awareness was also huge. You know, I don't know, I really do have good like body coordination myself. And I think that's definitely from dancing. And I know gymnastics is kind of similar in that sense, you know? So yeah.
When did you start swimming?
Well, I started swimming like pretty young too, but nothing competitive. I would say also at about four, my mom also like obviously started to learn how to swim then, and then I just built my way up and swam in my high school team. You know, I did the 50 meter freestyle. That was kind of my main event. I'm pretty anaerobic, so yeah, that I really enjoyed that, and yeah, swam throughout my school years. Yeah.
I ask because when like, you know, the age group athletes get into triathlon, it's almost like no matter how much they swim, they can't make the same progression in swimming as they do mm-hmm. in running and cycling, because we don't have the body awareness. And I wonder if mm-hmm. that body awareness in ballet and dancing is what allowed you to pick mm-hmm. it up really quickly and still get to that top level of the sport and not be a triathlete that struggles all their life trying to get into that front pack.
Yeah, I think it definitely helps. And I also know that just like starting swimming at a young age is also just so important, because like if you don't, it's just such a technique thing that like it just takes so much longer to get that going and learn it when you like say an adult, or you know, like you just don't have that base from swimming. And it just like, yeah, that would definitely be the hardest part, you know.
So you came to the United States by yourself in your late teens with the intention of actually being a professional triathlete, which is a really different track than so many people take. We've talked to so many pros on the podcast here, and you know, many of them have been well into their adult life and their professional careers when they decided to get into it, et cetera. But you, as a teenager, decided you wanted to be a pro triathlete, which is pretty amazing, and not a decision that a lot of young people would make. So, you know, talk about that.
So, I mean, growing up, I did a lot of kind of sports, and I knew that no matter what, I wanted to be a professional athlete. I just didn't know what. And it was just like kind of my final years of high school. I tried triathlon, and I don't know, I loved it. And I was just so inspired by the coach that I met and started training with in South Africa. And then he convinced me to come over to Boulder, Colorado just for a summer. And once I did that, kind of like it just, the rest was history, because I just, this was like what I wanted to do. I just, something just clicked, and I was just like, this is what I want to do. And I like, my parents just backed me 100%. And I was studying in Johannesburg, South Africa at the time. And I knew that if I wanted to do it, I had to do it 100%. And so, like, I gave up my studies to become a full-time pro and kind of went for it 100%. But it was definitely ballsy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and just because there's no guarantee, right? Like, I think a lot of people, we live up in Canada, and every young boy who plays junior hockey wants to be in the NHL. And, you know, I'm sure in the States, every young kid who plays football thinks he's going to be in the NFL, et cetera. So to say, I'm going to be a pro athlete and then choose your sport and then you make it, it's actually kind of amazing.
Well, I mean, you know, the first few years were incredibly hard, and there's just so much doubt, and you're always like, I don't know if I can do this. You know, you're not making money. The exchange rate was incredibly high, and my parents just helped me through, and just like every time I thought that I couldn't do it, they wouldn't allow me to give up, because I think they just saw something in me. They knew that, like, no matter what I did, I was always going to work hard, and I never give up, and I always do things to the best of my ability. So, and that's all I've ever known. So when I found something that I really wanted to do, I think that's why they supported that. And then it started to become like, oh, I really just want to make it in the sport. And so there's just like this hunger inside of you that, like, you'll do anything to, like, to make things happen. So, you know, you just put in the hard work, make the sacrifices and the best coaches and try to get off my feet. And like every year got a little bit better, but it's definitely hard.
How many years did it take to get to that point where you could say, like, I mean, it might be putting you on the spot a little bit to say, like, there was a point where there's air quotes made it, but like what you did was very different than what an ITU athlete would do, where they're kind of just shuffled along from sprint to Olympic to, like, they just go through it. And it's not like there is a really risky point where they've got to decide, okay, I'm putting everything into this. How many years was it between that move and getting to a point where you're like, okay, this is it. I'm established.
I mean, to be honest, it took a good 4 years to the point where I could, like, actually start making some money at races. And then that definitely helped. But yeah, it definitely took 4 years. And then by the fifth year, then, like, when I met Justin and I started being coached by JC, I just, things got so much better for me. And then once I started winning races, that definitely helped. I was able to get on the Timex multi-sport team. So that kind of sponsorship just kind of changed my life, because it allowed me to kind of, like, not have that financial stress that I was going through for the first, like, 4 years, you know, like, just trying to pay the bills and get through and, like, just hope that like, I'll make money at the next race. Whereas, like, now it's kind of like, I'm throwing myself into the biggest races because I actually want to compete with the best people. There's no ways I could have done that 3 years ago, you know?
So I guess for folks who maybe have not figured this out already, it's obvious Metzl Moore, you two are a couple. So just talk about how you obviously live together, you train together, and I guess you probably race together in many of the same races. Talk about how you're training, particularly how that overlaps, how you guys make it work, and races as well, just from the perspective of a professional triathlete couple.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unique for us. And I think we struggled when we first started dating in terms of, like, exactly how that was going to work for us in particular. I was working with Jesse before Jeannie and I started dating. And then she saw the way Jesse and I interacted and was like, hey, I kind of want to have a little piece of that as well. So then she signed on with Jesse. And I think in the beginning, we did a lot together and we trained a lot. And I think I came down a little bit to be at Jeannie's level. She maybe trained a little bit too hard to be at my level, but you know, we were newly dating, young love, like honeymoon phase. And we just wanted to spend all of our time together. So it wasn't necessarily the best move for us from an athletic perspective, but it was a good move maybe for our relationship. But ultimately we found out that we need to sort of just do our own things. And as Jesse got to know Jeannie better and got to know me more, our training, I don't think could be any more different.
Yeah. I mean, from a physical standpoint, we just completely different animals. So, and I know, you know, Jesse, he's probably one of the smartest people you'll meet. So not only the way he speaks to us, but the way he trains us is completely different. So now our programs are really, really different. Now and again, we can jog together or go for an easy bike ride. But for the most part, our key sessions are very specific and we kind of just dial in our own specific stuff and come home and have dinner together and carry on as normal people now.
Yeah. And I think that ultimately made sense for us. And you guys can probably attest to this. It was almost like we would go out during the day and do our training and then we'd come home and that was our work. And that, you know, we would say, okay, have a kiss and then go and I'll see you tonight. And then we would go off, do our own thing. And then we'd meet up 5 or 6 o'clock, like a lot of normal couples do. And that sort of seems to function for a lot of people. And it's worked out well for us.
That's very businesslike. Yeah, it is. It is a business that you guys are running there with Papa Kev.
Yeah. But I mean,
no, it is. Yeah, it is.
But at the same time, you know, that may be in a way better that you both have such different bodies and training styles and that Jesse has recognized that. Jesse Kropelnicki, your coach, in case anybody hadn't know who this Jesse was, we keep referencing that, you know, it in a way that might be good because honestly, I think you can as a couple spend too much time together. And then, you know, if you were doing the same training all day and then you got home and you sit down to dinner, it's like, hey, honey, what did you do today? Same thing you did, honey. What do we have to talk about?
There's
nothing.
Not much more to talk about.
Right. So, you know, in a way, it probably is a benefit to you, exactly, to your relationship, right?
Definitely.
What are the drawbacks of being in the same sport?
I struggled for, what's that?
We've gone through the past 2 weeks, actually.
Yeah. I think the biggest struggle we've had. Why don't we each say our biggest struggle? Because okay. My biggest struggle has been the fact that Jeannie and I have, like you said, done some of the same races. I'd say about 50% of our races are done together. And especially when we first started dating, Jeannie had just started off with Jesse and she had this like rapid success and she just went off and she started winning all these races and getting on all these podiums. And Jesse and I were still sort of in this weird phase where we were just trying to figure it out. And we weren't really worried about, he wasn't worried about the racing at that time. I obviously was, because we all care about racing, but he was more worried about just figuring me out from a physiological perspective. We hadn't really dialed it in yet. So I wasn't getting results and I was going to all these races coming down 10th, 15th, 20th or whatever. And Jeannie was going off and winning and we'd go to these races together and she'd have this elation of a second or a third or a first or whatever. And I'd have this massive disappointment of a 15th. And then that was the biggest struggle for us when she would win and I would do poorly at the same race, or we both felt like we were going to go to a race and go great. And we'd have opposite things. I'd race really well. Jeannie would race poorly. And then there's just this contrast of emotion is, I think, the biggest thing. And then we deal with that on a kind of micro scale every day where one of us is going awesome in training and the other one's feeling terrible. Similar to like after the QT2 camp, I was feeling awful and Jeannie's feeling great. But there have been equal number of times where I've felt amazing and Jeannie's going through a really tough spot. So it's like when we're not on the same page, I'd say that's the hardest part for me.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because we follow curling quite closely up here. Taryn used to be a curler and there are some curling couples, you know, just people who've, they meet as part of the business and then they get married. And I've always wondered, you know, they'll say on broadcast, for example, I'd rather be playing than watching my spouse play because it's easier for me to control things. But when I'm watching, my nerves are, you know, through the roof. And so I'd imagine that goes the same. But then I've asked the question, how hard is that when your spouse is winning and doing great and your season or your games are just going poorly, that must make it harder, right? Because you watch them having all the success and you're not having it and it's right there in your household sleeping in the bed next to you, that must make it tough.
Yeah, it makes it incredibly tough. And even from the other side, like, you wouldn't think, but like, even when I have like a great race and Justin has a disappointing race, I almost can't celebrate my race.
Right.
I care so much about Justin that like, I want to be there for him and I want to support him and I want to make him feel better. So I kind of like almost put my win under the carpet just for a little bit and don't really celebrate my success. So I've experienced that and it's definitely tough. And also when you have like a disappointing race and the other one does really well, it's just hard to like support each other and kind of like you want support for yourself from the other person. And it's just, it's really hard because if you're upset, you can't really be there for your partner. And it's just that really been tough for us to kind of deal with.
But on the other side, when you both go and you race well, there's no better feeling. Like, you know, if you win a race, that is the best feeling in the world. But if you and your partner win the same race, or you and your partner both go to a race and you have the race that you thought you were capable of and you go there and you have success, like, it's double the feeling of winning. It's the best in the world. So that's why we continue to go to races together, because we're not only searching for that individual satisfaction of winning a race, but if we can both go there, like, it's 10 times what it is to just do it on your own.
Have you both won the same race ever?
We have once.
Which one?
Yeah, we challenged Iceland.
Very cool.
Yeah, last year.
That must have been a freaking amazing day.
Yeah, it was probably the best. When you look back, and I'd say it was the best day of my career, for sure.
Well, yeah, it was so special because it was Justin's first kind of like half distance, you know, win. And I almost didn't win. I had to really pull a rabbit out of the hat there.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was really awesome to share a moment like that with each other.
And Jeannie, did you know that when you were coming to the line, did you know he had already won? Like, when you were still running your race, had you?
No, that's the best part. You should actually, we'll send you a video of me at the finish line when, like, because when I race, I know Justin's at the finish line for me and I never know how he's going to do. So my first question is always like, where did you come? You know? And it was just so amazing.
I
did it. And then I just like jumped on him and it was awesome.
We'll send you some of these awesome photos. We have these like amazing pictures that they had there of like, you know, Jeannie jumping up and down and both of us like crying at the finish line because we were so happy. It was a pretty special day.
You got the thumbnail planned for this podcast.
Yeah,
you're
no
done.
Kidding. Hey,
that's it.
Yeah.
That is the one.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Can I
ask specifically what it was, Jeannie, about how Jesse interacted with Justin that made you want to work with Jesse? Because I hung out with the guy for a few days there and I know that he drinks a lot of La Croix and
yep, as do I.
And a lot of protein powder. But like,
as do I.
But I didn't get any of the interaction that he has with you because I was just witnessing it. But like, what was it that you went like, I want some of that?
Yeah, you know, just the tone that Jesse kind of speaks to me and like the first conversation that I had with him, I don't know, he just like, I just felt like he really cared about me as a person and I was just in a place where I just needed that. And, you know, I don't know, I just needed something different and Justin's kind of program was different and I just wanted to try that and see how it worked for me. And yeah, I just, from just trying out JC's program, I was just like immediately happy with the change. And JC's just so responsive and really supportive. And that's, you know, like I said, what I needed at that time and what I need right now, honestly. So, yeah.
Can I get into some of the nitty gritty here about how you train, how each of you train? So, Jeannie, you're very anaerobic. You say you don't do a lot of speed work, but most of your runs are off the bike or a strength run. Can you explain just like for the age grouper that is,
and for the dummy who is me, what's a strength run?
Yeah. Well, even a little bit me, can you explain like what's a strength run? Why have you decided to not do speed work? Why so many brick workouts? Like just explain sort of the thought behind why you're training with the run the way that you are. Oh, and I should give the context for the listener that you're one of the best runners in the distance. Like, so that's an important thing to know.
Anna Hogg is the new woman to be right now. So, but yeah, in terms of my run program, I mean, it's nothing special, and there's no magic, honestly. I do get some touches of speed work on the track, especially just before races. But for the most part, I honestly just have aerobic runs. So JT is very much into zones. So you'll have like a ZR, which is kind of your recovery run zone. So you want to keep under a certain heart rate. So for me, that's like keeping my heart rate under 140. Then I have like a zone one run, which is typically like a steady aerobic run. And that's kind of like, for me, my heart rate would be between like 150 and 160. And then like then going up, it's like zone two, and then zone three is getting pretty much to where you like sprinting. So most of my running is in zone one. And I really like to build that. So meaning you start out nice and easy, kind of jogging, warming up, and then you start like dropping down the pace and building the heart rate. So towards the end of the run, you're basically going at a pace that is pretty fast, and your heart rate is at the top of that zone, if that makes sense. And I typically like to do that right off a hard bike ride. That really helps with like durability and like just kind of simulating that kind of triathlon run that you'll have, especially if you have like a hard bike workout. That's kind of like a triathlon, because we have to run after biking really hard, you know. And when I say strength runs, I really like running hills out on the dirt. Here in Boulder, we have a res bar where there's just like rolling terrains and like some pretty hard hills. And I just love doing that. I think it's really good to do, because it's easy to go on the track and run hard. To go on the hills and build that leg strength is hard too. And I think it's working for me right now, you know.
Physiologically, why is that what's working for you? Because you have, say, like friends of ours, Sarah True. That felt like a real name drop as I was saying it. Yeah. Sarah True talking about how she does so much work on the track and it's the best work that you can do. But that's obviously not what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's risky to go on the track, because like if you don't control yourself and you either do things too hard or do too much of that speed work, that's where like injury comes into like that risk factor of getting injured. And being a bit more anaerobic, I don't need as much speed work, because it's kind of like, I hope this doesn't sound bad, but it's kind of easier for me to go at a really fast pace. I'm kind of working to train another system, and I need to be able to go for a longer time at a maybe more steady pace. That's kind of what my physiology needs, because for me, I can go and sprint, like, but I don't find that hard. What I want to do is kind of work at that steadier state, holding a pace for a longer time, if that makes sense.
That actually makes perfect sense. That's what I that's what I actually struggle with, that like I could go and out sprint my training partners who can run a half marathon 20 minutes faster than I can. Mm-hmm. And I can out sprint them in a 200 meter, like nothing, but turn that into a 5K and they're putting minutes into me. Maybe I need some ZR and some zone one.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So Justin, you're running here. Same sort of thing. Like while we were in the van, Jesse was talking to me. And while we were at the clay roads in Claremont, I was like, ooh, he's moving really well. And Jesse just said, yeah, take a lot of work. Big guy like that takes a lot more to work on to get his run up to speed. And then I think he stuck his head out the window and like we just kind of got sidetracked and I didn't follow up on that. What was the work that he did to get your run in shape?
Yeah, I think Jeannie and I, like we've mentioned before, are complete polar opposites. So when I first signed on with Jesse, he didn't know really what my physiology is. And that's how he is with every athlete. It takes time to flesh that out. So I started off doing a very similar program to Jeannie, because that's sort of like the QT2 way. It's to start off just with the aerobic base stuff first. And then if that doesn't work, you make a change. That's really how any program works anyways. And so I started off with that aerobic base running and I got really fit, but I never got really fast. And so we found with me, especially, I've got this enormous aerobic engine and I can go for all day. There's no problem. I can go out and do 7-hour training sessions and I can handle a really massive training load with a ton of intensity. But I don't really have that pop to do a 50 meter sprint in the pool or to do a 200 or 400 repeat on the track or do, you know, a 30 second sprint on the bike. That's not my thing. I love, you know, an hour effort or a 2 hour run or like really long 1,000 yard efforts in the pool. Those are sort of my bread and butter. So ultimately Jesse and I found that out, and I've got other things that make my physiology challenging because I'm a big guy. I'm really tall. I'm 6'4" and I weigh about 170 pounds, which is, I think, 76 kilograms. So I think, and I've got these really long legs. So moving these big levers and having more mass to move was kind of a challenge for us. So we went back and said, okay, what are things that we need to work on? We need to work on reducing my ground contact time. We need to work on increasing my hip flexor ability and flexibility, strength and flexibility. And we need to run fast because you're not good at running fast. So
can we just explain what ground contact time is?
Yeah, ground contact time. So I've got these really long legs, like I said, and before Jesse and I started working on it, I was spending a lot of time on the ground, which is not very efficient. You want to sort of hit the ground and then immediately pick your foot up and move on to the next step. So if your ground contact time isn't very low, typically you're not spending a lot of time moving forward. You want to spend less time on the ground and more time moving forward. So we worked on doing some plyometrics in the gym and some more snappy, fast running in order to decrease that and improve my ability to just move forward faster. I think that's everyone's goal, is to move forward faster. Whichever way you get there, you know, this was just my method of getting there. So yeah, we just worked on all these little fine details. It wasn't necessarily, I would say, I think he found it easier, quote unquote, with Genie, because he was just like, okay, look, we're going to go the normal QT2 way and it's going to either work or it's not, and then we'll find a path. And just so happened that she was one of those people, and I'd say about 50% of people fall into that category where it just works and you continue doing that. And once you find the thing that works, you don't change it. But until you find what works, you got to keep changing and evolving to figure that out until it doesn't work anymore. And then you find the next thing. So Jesse and I went through about a 3-year process to figure out what worked. And I think last year we saw me with some really, really fast competitive run splits and some good proof that it's working.
Yeah. If I remember right, your running when you started with them was like a 120-ish, 121 in a race. And now it's down to 114 or 15. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think I had 3 or 4 splits around the 115 range last year. My fastest was 112, like high 112.
Yeah, that's a long way to move up when you're already starting that fast at the 120. That's cool. Let's start kind of working our way towards wrapping it up with, we started calling these rapid fire questions.
No, you called them rapid fire, but I said there's nothing rapid about this.
Nothing rapid about this. So they're kind of like medium fire questions about coupleness, where we'll ask you a question and we'll see if this sounds okay. If you answer them at like 3, 2, 1, the same time.
Yeah, like that game show. What was that, like, oh, the match game or something like that? Was that what it was called?
I know this game. Yeah, I got this.
Well, don't worry. We've only got like 5 questions for you. So this isn't going to, we're not going to put your relationship in jeopardy over this.
Oh gosh.
Okay, so we'll ask the question and you two do the 3, 2, 1 answer. First one.
Okay.
Who does the majority of the cooking?
3, 2, 1.
Genie.
Okay, that's
an easy one. Yeah. That's a duck.
Yeah, no problem.
Who eats more? 3, 2, 1.
Justin.
Probably an easy one, too.
I'm 170 pounds. I mean,
well, that's a good point. Listen, there's some female triathletes who can throw it back, though, you know? They can put it down.
That's true.
Okay, who is messier? 3, 2, 1.
Justin.
you did not even flinch there, Genie.
And
I had to think about it.
He waited you out. Yeah. You had 3 seconds.
Well, certain things. It's very particular.
No. Okay, my training stuff is probably more messy. And your clothes are me.
I think
I put him in the bin.
I think that everyone's answer would be the other person, but Justin, you were just thinking like, am I ready to risk this right now?
Yeah.
Should I just say myself?
Right. I can't even on that, but
all right, fine.
Okay, next question. And this, you know, in our relationship, my relationship with Taryn, there is quite a bit of debate about sort of the answer to this question. So this is why we're asking this. It might not be obvious. Who asked who out first? 3, 2, 1.
Justin.
Okay. Might have been an obvious
one. Story. I almost have to tell this story. I feel like
do
tell it.
More like
we were going to ask how you met and how you got started. So please do tell it.
Okay.
All right. So you can interject whenever you feel like I'm not getting it correct.
Okay. That's nice of you.
I had met Jeannie. Yeah. I mean, it's been 3 years. It's been a while. But I had met Jeannie about 3 years ago, right around this time, at an open water swim race in Boulder. And I actually had seen her before because we were both on the podium at a race, in like a random race in Knoxville. And there's like photos you can look back and see both of us like standing next to each other on this podium. But for whatever reason, like we didn't talk and we didn't hang out.
Yeah, you're like scary.
She said I was scary. I didn't think I was scary. Yeah. I don't know. And so anyways, pretty much the whole summer went by, and that was the first year I came to Boulder. And the whole summer went by, and then we had a mutual friend who was like, you know what, do you know Jeannie? Like, he was training with her or something, and then he was like, you should ask her out or something. And so I sent her a message on Facebook, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, we should hang out. I wanted to go on a bike ride. That was my lead. Nice. You were like...
And I was like, no.
Yeah, she was like,
I go on enough bike rides, thanks.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a straight up no. Like, if she just gave me a no, I would have been cool with that. But it was sort of like she'd make plans and then she'd be like, oh no, my training changed. And I'd say like, well, let's go get coffee. And she's like, well, yeah, okay, let's do it. And then she'd cancel. And then we went on this whole thing. And I was living with my friend at the time. And I was like, dude, like, I don't know. She just keeps canceling on me. I don't know. And then 4 or 5 times went by where she canceled on me. And I said, I'm done. I'm totally done.
Oh, I know this game. I know what's happening. Jeannie was testing to see. She was testing to see how into her you were.
Or she was trying to make you want her more.
No, I don't know. Tell them which one it was.
No, I was just like, I don't know. I was nervous. And then I was just like, I don't want to. I didn't want to be rude.
But I was persistent because for some reason, this guy kept telling me more about her. And I was like, she's the perfect girl for me. I've never known someone who's my age, who's into triathlon as much as I am, who is like supposedly cool, also beautiful. And I was like, she's got all the boxes. Like, I don't know how this isn't going to work. And so I was just very persistent up until about 5 times. And I was like, no, I'm done. And then I had broken my ribs and like hurt my shoulders in a bike crash. And then I went off to this race in Austria.
Oh, you went to the World.
Yeah, it was the World Champs in Austria. But I got, like, I could barely race. Like, I just spent all the money to go over there, and I was like, I'm going to go anyways because I spent all this money on it. And I went and I raced with my ribs all messed up. And then I came back.
And then I felt bad. Like, I felt bad.
I got the pity vote now.
Hey, whatever it takes, man. Whatever it takes.
Coffee. Yeah.
And then we went for coffee. And that was it.
And that was it. He was so sweet, and I really liked him. And then we just, we went for a run, and then we went for a bike ride, and then it was...
Yeah, and then
we
moved in together after like dating for like 6 weeks.
Hey, we did too.
We did too, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And now you guys have your own hashtag.
Yes, exactly.
Right. We don't have a hashtag.
We don't have a hashtag.
After like 7 years, they have a hashtag.
Yeah, well, you know what? The way you get one is you just make one up like we did.
Yeah, well, I've made up a YouTube channel that seems to get across that I think I'm smart, and I've fooled lots of people.
Yeah.
So I can start a hashtag. Exactly, of fooling people into thinking I'm smart.
You already have a hashtag, though. It's Triathlon Taryn, and there's no room for me in there.
Fair.
Well, you should make one. Just say Triathlon Taryn and me. Hashtag Triathlon Taryn and me.
And me.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to catch on somehow. I don't know.
I'll add it to my social post and then it'll catch on.
There you are so thoughtful. I really appreciate that.
Team effort. Solidarity, brother. I like it.
Yeah.
So where are you two racing the rest of the season?
So our next race is St. George in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to do Monterey the weekend after. So I'll do a back-to-back. And then Justin's going to do his first Ironman here in Boulder.
Yep.
Ooh, that's
the aerobic guy gets to show his strength. Finally.
After how many years of slogging out long runs?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, it's really been like how many years of people telling me I can't do an Ironman. And that's been like 11. So
now you're going to show them.
Can I ask why?
Yeah. Just because I was too young and I wasn't ready. Like, I've wanted to do an Ironman since I was like 12 or 13 years old. And I couldn't do it when I was a kid because I was 12 or 13 years old. And then I got into triathlon and I was doing short course. And then I signed up with Jesse and he said, you are nowhere near ready. And now finally I got the go ahead because I'm ready. So I'm excited.
You haven't seen the guy in person, Kim, but the man's a locomotive.
Well, this is exciting.
Big Mets try on the move.
We'll be following.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah,
Metzler Express.
The Metzler Express. Hashtag. The man has so many hashtags. Yeah, I'm jealous. Right? Oh,
Jeannie, will you be live tweeting his race?
I'm gonna have to, but it's hard because it's just like, I wouldn't say that's one of my strengths. I really just want to be present there for Justin on the day, but I'm gonna do my best.
Well, maybe Taryn and I should head down and live tweet the race, live cover the race.
I didn't tell you about that. I didn't tell you about that. We might be going around that time.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll see you there. Maybe this wasn't just something I just pulled out of the air. No, it's actually happening. All right.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Let's wrap it up here. Who are the sponsors for the rest of the year and where can everyone find you online?
Okay. Don't we have one more rapid fire question to do?
You ended it so well, I mean,
we could do a rapid fire.
Yeah, but you can't go back now after that.
Oh, okay. Well, I just didn't want to like short him on his rapid fire. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you ended it so well. I didn't want to ruin it if we had a dud of a rapid fire.
Well, here's one last one though. Okay. So here I was going to get, you answer for each other. What is the one item your partner can't travel without?
Okay.
3, 2, 1.
Sleep machine.
Wow. Okay. For the girl who falls asleep anywhere, you need a sleep machine?
Sound machine.
No. Still.
Yeah, it makes an ocean sound, like white noise almost. I'm a pretty fussy sleeper.
Unless you're on an airplane.
Oh, I thought Justin was joking there and saying that he can't travel without the sleep machine, referring to Jeannie.
Well, no, that's what they answer for each other. Jeannie needs a sleep machine.
I thought he was joking.
Another hashtag. Hashtag sleep machine. You refer to Jeannie as that.
Yes.
There we go. Okay. We still ended the rapid fire on a good note.
Yeah. All right. Sponsors, and where can we find you online?
So Jeannie and I are both part of the Timex team. They're our title sponsor. And yeah, as part of that team, we have a bunch of really awesome partners, obviously headlining with Timex. And then we work with Trek Bikes very closely. And you'll see our awesome speed concepts out on the road. We also work with Castelli really closely and Blue 70, Pioneer Home Audio headphones, stages, power meters. And then Jeannie and I both work with First Endurance for nutrition, and they supply most of our race nutrition. Then I personally work with Juice Performer, and they make beet juice and cherry juice, which also is awesome for performance. And
yeah, we also have Ice Friction. We just signed on Oakley sunglasses. That was pretty cool. Feedback Sports. Those are the trainers that we take pretty much on all of our trips. That's pretty cool. You can actually break it up into two pieces and put it into your luggage, which makes it super easy. So you can just ride in your hotel room and not stress about riding your bike on dangerous roads. So that's been huge.
Yeah. We also got our day one sponsors, Mom and Dad. They'll come through occasionally when in need.
Love Mom and
Dad. They're the best. And best places to find you online?
The best places are probably Instagram. I'm at Jeannie Seymour.
Yeah, and I'm at Big Mets Tribe. And also my blog is, my Instagram and my blog are my two sort of places where you can find me.
That was excellent, guys.
JustinMetzoTriathlete.com.
That was so much fun.
That was fun. This was like, was this our first? No, we've done a double date before. This is like a triathlon podcast double date.
Yes.
This was fun.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. You have to come to Boulder and we'll do it in person.
Apparently we are. I'm hearing that just now.
There were some emails traded yesterday. Yes.
Oh, who knew?
Thanks, guys.
I love it.
Thank you so much, guys. Good luck.
Have a good night.
Thanks, you too.
Bye. All right, take care. Bye.
If there was anything on the podcast that you heard and you want to know more about, you can visit our show notes at triathlonterran.com/topics/triathlonterranpodcast. We'll have all of the links listed there. Any other info that you may not have had time to write down or whatever, it's listed there for you in perpetuity.
Something newer, juicier, freer.
We love free.
We've had resources kind of scattered throughout the website for the past year that we've built up. Well, I have put that all on one single page on the website at triathlonterran.com/free resources. Just by entering your email address, you can get a free swim drill program, a free strength training program, a running drill program. And as we start coming out with things, everything will be there. So you can check it now. You can check it later.
come early, come often.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be adding stuff all the time, so make sure you check it out frequently. Also, if you've got questions for Taryn, and many of you do, and you leave them in the YouTube comments, Facebook, Instagram, etc., we're trying to aggregate that all into one spot so everybody can see and hear the answer. And that's why we've now launched the Triathlon Trainiask podcast, because it's Trainiacs asking questions. So what we want you to do is head over to triathlontaryn.com/trainiask. If you have a question, you'll record it and Taryn may answer it on the podcast. He's recording them every single weekday, and you can find the podcast on every single podcast player out there. And Trainiask is spelled T-R-A-I-N-I-A-S-K.
Short nuggets of info. Every right. episode, I guarantee under 10 minutes.
Perfect.
And it's hard to get me to stop talking, so this is a feat. Finally, last thing that you can do is, if you like this show or the Trainiask show when you check it out, head over to iTunes, give us a review, good, bad, indifferent. Hopefully 5 stars, because we're pretty awesome.
Reviews just really help us out.
It really helps with the iTunes algorithm. However it happens, it works. It's internet magic and helps other new or aspiring Trainiacs discover us. So that would be much appreciated.
Thanks, folks. See you next time.